When we do turn it.
Their first red zone turnover of the night. Yunks shooting it the other way. Sanner chased by Randall. Sanner! Full extension! Hauls in the score for Carolina!
Welcome back. It's Swing Pass Week 3 recap time. I apologize again for the technical difficulties, but the show must go on. I am Adam Ruffner. That is Cameron Brock. We have 10 games to get through from the Week 3 slate. Starting chronologically at the top with DC's one-goal, low-scoring 12-11 win over Boston on Friday night, which briefly put the Breeze in first place in the East Division, a long-sought-after position for that franchise. And yet, with their big win over Boston, it was kind of nullified a little bit as the Glory went on the road the next night, getting a big 9-goal win in Philly. Boston now improving to 3-1, taking over their rightful claim over first place in the East Division, and really, I think, upending the standards heading into the season of how that division would look. Moving on to Saturday night in the big game of the week rematch between Carolina and Atlanta, the home team Flyers once again just holding out basically end-to-end over the hustle. Another impressive defensive performance from Carolina in their 22-19 win. They get 8 breaks and are now up to 70% defensive efficiency against Atlanta this season. Again, Atlanta allowed just 1 break against the reigning champion New York in week 2. So the kind of work that Carolina's defense is doing right now is something we'll get to when we get more embedded into the official recap of that game. But just kind of running down the rest of the scores and headlines from week 3. Minnesota moving to 2-0 with an impressive 16-14 defensive showing in Chicago. They turned the disc over just 13 times, their fewest in their last 15 starts. Montreal finally getting a win and snapping their 19-game losing streak in Toronto. Austin also getting a win in Dallas. Indy, you guys. And Madison getting their debuts to 2024 season, also picking up their first wins of the season. And maybe most impressively on the entire week 3 weekend, Oakland going up into the Northwestern corridor, facing Portland and Seattle on back-to-back road games and coming away with 1-goal wins in each of those performances. Not necessarily pristine ultimate, but I think given where the Spiders ended up last year, dropping a pair of road games and bowing out of playoff contention after they controlled their own destiny, a really impressive reversal for this Oakland franchise in the road, particularly down a few starters. We'll get into all that, but Cam, you're coming off of your first game. You had to wait 3 weeks for your first set of action in the 2024 season. I just want to ask you, how's it feel getting back on this season? You guys look good in a 9-goal win, obviously, against a Detroit team that's struggling, but how you feeling?
Feeling great. First game, I'm always interested to see how I feel afterwards. And felt great. Like, felt like I could have just gone out there and run it back. Like, I felt great physically. I was happy with a lot of the things that we did in our first game as we're trying a lot of new things this year in Indy. We know we have a lot of improving to do, but glad to get that first win on the board. Excited to welcome in Atlanta this week. So, at the end of the day, it's all about just wins and losses, right? So, happy to come out with a win and, 11 more to go, right? 11 more to go.
Maybe we should just move into the game of the week matchup. You mentioned Atlanta, so let's talk about them facing off in Carolina. Again, the Flyers winning 22-19 in that battle. Carolina just had 24 total turnovers in their 2 games against the Hustle. As I mentioned before, they were 19 of 27 on break opportunities combined in weeks 1 and week 3 against Atlanta. That comes out to a 70% defensive success rate. Just kind of absurd. They're number 2 now in the league in team completion percentage, Carolina is, and most notably, I think, on their offense is this trio of downfield speedsters that they have. This last weekend, they were missing a host of starters, including Alan Laviolette, who was so crucial and productive in the team's week 1 win against Atlanta. But even without him, it was just, once again, this kind of balanced yet dangerous Carolina offensive attack led by Anders Jungs, Grayson Sanner, and Terrence Mitchell. Obviously, there's you could pretty much name any one of the offensive starters for Carolina and kind of take over an analysis of them. But I wanted to start with this trio of speedsters and the leading scores for the team. Jungs, Sanner, and Mitchell all in double-digit scores already after two games. They have just two turnovers combined amongst the three of them. Jungs and Sanner have 25 total scores combined, over 1,600 yards of combined offense. Sanner doesn't have a turnover on the season. And per Evan Leppler, with talking with him after their big win, Sanner is now 20-1 all time for the Carolina Flyers, a true underrated secret ingredient for their success over the past few seasons. He missed all of last year with an injury, so going to be really intriguing how he continues to fit into this Carolina team going forward. And then Terrence Mitchell, you know, I feel like last year he was one of those players that got lost in the shuffle. They used him on defense, it felt like, half the time, not necessarily his traditional role. He's now filling in as kind of this continuation cutter role. He's got 590 yards in two games against Atlanta, 10 total scores, 3 assists, 7 goals. He just looks good. This whole Carolina team just looks good. Atlanta didn't falter in the same way that they did in week one this past Saturday, but they didn't have any area, it felt like, on either offense or defense that they could leverage against this Carolina team. There was just not a foothold for them to take in this matchup with the Flyers.
Yeah, and the final score is not even quite indicative. Like, three goals is kind of, you think like, oh, it was fairly close. This really was a five-goal lead, and then Atlanta scores and kind of gets a meaningless break with a very little time left. I mean, Carolina dominated this game, not quite to the extent they dominated the first one, but with both teams out, some pretty important pieces. Carolina just handled it better. Carolina is so deep. I mean, you mentioned the people on offense and how well they're playing, but I almost feel like you could go to every single person that's put a jersey on for them in their two games this year and just be like, yeah, that guy is absolutely balling out right now.
Dylan Hawkins.
It is an embarrassment of
riches. Dylan Hawkins looking great. They've got, you know, Alexander Wilcox in the second season. He's 19, 20 years old. He's, as Evan Leppler mentioned on the broadcast too, he's the descendant of a Olympian fencer. He does fencing right now at Duke University, which I think is a really interesting skill set for a handler to have.
They got a great fencing team, by the way. I know this because I know too much.
Yeah, you're a Duke fan. We don't want to reveal that too heavily on this show, I don't think. no, but to your point, Elijah Long is once again just sort of threading in between all the spaces and being what they need as far as a stabilizing piece. Trevor Lynch makes plays wherever they slot him in. As I was talking to you in our pre-show prep, they've got a size to them this year that is just noticeable. I mean, even down Henry Fisher on defense, they can run Matt Tucker, Drew Swanson, Cooper Williams, William Coffin, who is really starting to emerge on this team as both a playmaker and a leader on defense. Like, these players are already 6'2" plus, but they play even larger than that. And that isn't even getting into the Fairfaxes. Terrence Mitchell is 5'10", but that may as well be like cast to the side. Like, that is not indicative of how he plays vertically. Even Jungs and Sanner, you know, these are two maybe what you would call undersized offensive players. It does not matter in terms of how they perform on the field. I mean, they get to their spots and they know exactly what they're doing. To me, through 3 weeks of play, this team looks head and shoulders above the competition. And I know we had some ideas about where this Carolina team could be after kind of coming off of a very uncharacteristic 7-win regular season and first round exit in 2023, but man, they look good.
Yeah, the biggest question mark for me right now is, what do they look like against a non-Atlanta
team? And they've always been the big brother in that, right?
It's kind of They have. Last year was kind of the first time it really felt like there was a reversal. Of course, if we go back and look at the rosters for last year, Carolina's roster was so topsy-turvy throughout the season, and there were some players who were injured for the entire year, some who just weren't playing that year, and then the injury bug hit them about as hard as any team in the league. So it was really hard to get a handle on who Carolina was last year. This year feels a lot different. But it's really hard also to get a pulse on Atlanta. Atlanta has played three games, but they've played a New York team that has been pretty unimpressive in their two games so far, and Carolina twice, who has looked really good, but only against Atlanta. So I think I'm really curious to see, is it just like a thing where they have Atlanta's number this year? Do they just match up super well with them? Are we going to see, like, when they play Austin, for example, is that going to be a bit more of a challenge, maybe stylistically or just with individual matchups that are harder for them to take? I don't know. I think Carolina looks really good. I think you're right. They look like the best team in the league right now. And but I do want to see what these teams look like when they play somebody else. Because right now we only have data for Carolina in two home games against Atlanta. They haven't had to go on the road yet either. So I do still have some questions, but they aren't big questions. They're very small questions because everyone looks phenomenal right now. Anders Jungs looks like, you know, two games in, granted, but like an odds on favorite for, like, he's at the top of the MVP race right now.
Yes.
With some others, but he's been playing phenomenally. He's seems to be open all over the field. He's beating people deep with both his throws and his legs. Had that great catch at the beginning of the game. I think it was for Carolina's first or second point where he just barely got his toe in before going out the back of the end zone. And yeah, he's playing at the same level, maybe even at a higher level than he was in like the 2021 or 2022 season when he was just, you know, all over the place. So really good to see a Carolina team back to being the type of team we expect from them after kind of a hiatus last year.
So you won't have to wait too much longer for their first matchup with Austin in 2024, although it will come in a couple weeks. Their next game for the Flyers is May 31st at Austin, which is one you're just going to have to circle with a Sharpie. And then 2 weeks after that, they face Austin again at home. So we'll get a really quick sense of where those two franchises stack up. And I want to get back a second to Jungst in particular, because you mentioned MVP. And I even kind of thought, after his first performance, and I wrote about it in last year's power rankings, he was just somebody who, through the course of whatever kind of alchemy, has sort of become underrated in a way, which doesn't entirely make sense for the fact that he makes everything look so easy. His speed and his field IQ and his ability to know where his spots are, it kind of makes him unguardable in a very real way. And when you see his expansion of his throwing repertoire, that open up backhand that he's developed the past couple of years in particular, he had one throw to Terrence Mitchell kind of cross field, just using that new frisbee to really drive it out into space. He really gets a lot of leverage despite not having some of the frame or length that other throwers have. He's got such a compact type delivery. And again, with that new frisbee, it just produces a lot of velocity. And he had another one too, a red zone pass where he just sort of threaded a needle really, really quickly as a thrower, which again, just speaks to the expansiveness of his game at this point, that he's really coming into his own. He's always been this explosive playmaker, right? I mean, he scored 50 goals as a rookie in 2021. Even after his injury, when he came back in 2022, he looked really, really good for them in their playoff games. And last year, again, the miasmas of this team, I think, just had him slotted into, oh, here's the 10 to 15 guys on the Flyers who we know perennially are like all UFA caliber, but depending on their production numbers and sort of their fitness in a given season, where they're going to slot in. But now all of a sudden in 2024, being a captain, being a leader on this team, it's just so clear he is the focal point and the primary option for them in so many scenarios.
I think probably where the underrating part comes out that you kind of mentioned, and thank you for correcting me, it was 2021 where he had the huge season, not 2022. I think it's part in 2022, him missing almost the whole season. And then, you know, the playoff game against New York at championship weekend, he did have kind of, I mean, the whole Carolina team had a rough go of it. I thought in particular, we saw what we were expecting to see was maybe shots deep to Anders. And instead what we saw was him throwing some questionable deep balls. So he didn't play his best in that game. And then last year, on the whole season, he played 11 games in the regular season, played in their playoff game. Combined in those games, he was plus 23 in 12 games. He's already plus 14 after two. Yeah. I mean, he's on pace to eclipse his plus minus from last year by game four. So, I mean, he's just statistically on a different level this year than he was last year. I think it's one of those things, too, where so much of Frisbee is dependent on who's out there with you. Like, you can't take, at least not in today's league, you could have done this in 2012, but you can't take a great player and put him in a situation where the lineups are constantly changing, where people are in and out with injuries and availability, and expect him to just like produce. Mm-hmm. Like, the league is too good. It's too deep at this point. You need some consistency. You need your best players available, because we're seeing the effects of this in New York so far early in the season, right? Like, I don't think anyone is going to like tell me that they don't have great players on their team. But when you're trying to fit in new pieces and you're not quite got the chemistry yet, like, things just aren't going to look the same. You're just not going to produce at the same level. So, I think that's kind of what happened to Durs last year, and then missing a lot of 2022. We forgot just how good this guy was in 2021, where he looked near unstoppable. So I think we're seeing a return to that as the availability of players in these first couple games and the talent they've been able to add to the team has just really helped them to take off early in this season. And I honestly expect him to be kind of on this throughout the season. I know he'll miss probably some time. I think he's on the world roster, right? So he'll probably miss something at some point. But I think when he's there, he is going to be a threat constantly throughout the game. And when you're also surrounded with other players who are playing so well, like, what are you going to do defensively? You can't just key in on one guy, because it's not just one guy. They are playing so well across the board right now that all they have to do is worry about their individual matchups, because other teams are not going to be able to afford to like put help over the top or to do something where they're focusing on just a couple of players, or they're just going to get burned somewhere else.
There's no strain, right? And I kind of wanted to get into the specific tactics of why that's happening on offense for Carolina, where I've heard it before from certain coaches. In particular, I remember listening to an interview with Bryce Merrill from Salt Lake about how they took many of their offensive precepts from what Carolina was running in 2021 and just sort of the general, I think, system that the Flyers have had for several seasons. And I feel like at the beginning of this year, with the new Frisbee, the past 2 years of new pulling rules and sort of defensive meta adjustments and everything else, the Flyers' approach to offense has become so much more salient as like the number one with a bullet kind of system because of how quickly they attack horizontal space. And I feel like especially against Atlanta, that was just so evident. I mean, this Flyers team can go from one rail to the other side of the field within 2 to 3 throws, and they kind of almost attack it like they're going up line or that they're trying to hook it. They'll almost put their handlers in like a power position and encourage them to really press the velocity of throws horizontally so that then they get that rail look upfield and they just have the ability to isolate a continuation thrower with a receiver like Fairfax or Mitchell or Jungst or Sanner in single coverage downfield, and it just looks easy every single possession. There's no, again, strain. There's no force. There's no sort of stickiness that I think we're seeing so often in other offensive performances. We'll get to the Boston and DC game in a minute where there was a lot of that kind of constipation, and there's just none of that for the Flyers. And again, I know Atlanta was missing some of its key defensive pieces, but that's still a really good system. And the Flyers just moved through it like
they're
it was
dangerous.
Nothing.
I don't know. And then you look defensively too. Like, we're gushing about the offense right now, but like defensively, they're just humongous. It's a complete no-fly zone. Like, any disc floating in the air feels like, yeah, you might have a guy that can go up and get it, but Carolina's got three. So like, right now they look like a team that has no weakness. Now, is there one that gets found throughout the course of the season? It's a long season. Someone undoubtedly will expose something, but right now they have looked, you know, like everything is beyond reproach right now. It is all working all over the place. So, if there's one thing I think we talked about in their last matchup, like, can they actually get blocks when they need to? Like, that might be the big thing. Can they force these like blocks in small spaces? I think in the air and in the deep space, they're going to have a very good time defensively. But when they really need to ratchet up pressure in a tight game, can they force the issue in the small spaces, in the middle spaces? That might be an area that could potentially be exploited, but it hasn't been exploited yet. So to my knowledge, no.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that's indicative of how they sort of flush discs, out of the backfield area and into downfield scenarios where their height can go make plays. You know, like Seth Weaver, they were down Sol Yannick this past weekend, but Siraj Mataraju was doing work on Austin Taylor. Like, this Flyers handler defensive unit, though they don't necessarily produce a ton of takeaways, is very good at just sort of flustering and flushing handlers out of their preferred zones. And I thought you saw that with Atlanta, where Austin Taylor, Bobby Ley, Christian Olsen, they didn't have bad games, but none of them could really get into rhythm. I mean, Austin Taylor was forced downfield and he made a couple of plays as a receiver, but that would be considered a win, I think, for a Flyers defensive point, is forcing out one of the best throwers into a downfield isolation look. Like, you'll sort of take that as a win in any given point. And so, yeah, I totally agree with you. I said to somebody else this week, if they were to play any other team right now, I think the Flyers would win by multiple goals. I think that at this point in the season, they're kind of head and shoulders above the competition for how they look. And again, especially against this Atlanta team, which is down some starters in week three, but was coming off of one of the most impressive victories we've seen in the past few seasons.
Yeah, but you mentioned DC Boston. I'm curious to get that.
Yeah, I mean, that was a real slugfest on Friday night in the East Division. Again, DC prevailing 12-11, just 23 combined goals. That figures to be almost the mark to beat for lowest total goal score this season. I would have to go back and really comb some stats to figure out the last time a full regulation game was that low scoring, but it wasn't exactly sloppy. It was just that both teams clearly had an ideation around how important red zone possessions were and just maintaining the disc. Boston again dropping it on the road, but I thought their defensive approach to DC was really solid. We talked about it, I think, as we were texting throughout the game, but Ben Katz playing sort of a middle linebacker role in that Boston defense makes them real formidable, because Glory have a lot of defenders who can go and get the disc. I mean, we talked about their rookie defensive impacts from Jonas Stang-Osborne and Rowan Dunkerley the week prior in week two, but they just have a lot of athletes on that D-line. And Katz's ability to sit in the middle of almost any offensive attack and play this free safety poach, I know exactly when to hand off, I know exactly when to look over here, I know how to decoy into space, I know when to do blind sprints back over my shoulder to recover into a position that I otherwise looked like I was leaving available. I mean, he's been playing maniacally. He didn't start for them in week two, but his two appearances for Boston so far this season, I think he's looked like one of the 10 best defenders in the league.
Yeah, it really changes things up for a team that really struggled to stop DC last year. We didn't see a lot of pressure from Boston on the DC matchups last year. They weren't able to break with any consistency. It does definitely feel like Boston has the capability now to slow down DC, to actually generate some sort of counterattack. This game went down to the wire. It was kind of everything we could hope for in this matchup. Like, a Boston team that has raised its level to the top of the East, and an East that feels like it is a little bit wide open. Like, for the first time, you know, since what, 2018, maybe, it feels like there's not a clear team that's going to come out of this division that might turn into a bunch of, and this had the feel of, and you know, this living in the Midwest, it felt like a Big Ten, like an Iowa football game. Like, it just,
ooh, that's like some stank on it.
It's like, yeah, like Iowa, Wisconsin, like just two teams that aren't going to score a lot of points. They're just going to throw haymakers at each other and see who's standing when the clock hits all the zeros at the end. I could not, I know I've talked to you about this multiple times. I could not get over the missed opportunities from Boston though. At the end of
the word,
and at the end of the fourth.
Say it, Chuck. Say the word.
Call a timeout. Oh my gosh. Boston coaches, I hope you're listening. You know what? I know someone from Boston is listening. Call a dang timeout. Like, they get for at the end of the second quarter, there's like a minute left. Boston gets a turnover. They have a timeout. They've got the disc. Perfect opportunity to call a timeout and put your O-line in. Neither team was moving the disc well, but in particular, the defenses weren't moving it well when they did get the disc. Like, and that's Jeff Babbitt time, right? Like, you're going to be potentially throwing something up at the last second. Like, you need to get your guys out there. And they didn't. They ended up turning it over. You know, no score there, right? Like, tragic. End of the game, fourth quarter. They get the disc, what, a minute and a half left-ish? I think it's like minute 25. They get the disc on defense, tie game, chance to break to go up one. They have two timeouts. They hadn't even used a timeout in the second half. And what happens? They throw into a poach within like 15 to 20 yards of their defending end zone. DC gets it and scores with a little under a minute left, I think, or about a minute left. And now Boston, instead of having the chance to put their offense out there and take the lead, now has to put them out there with a minute left in a game where scoring was at a premium, as you mentioned, and try to generate a score in that minute in a game where they were averaging a score every 2 minutes combined between the teams. So it's like, it's coaching errors, right? Like, I mean, this falls on the coaching staff. You cannot expect the players who are out there full of adrenaline, believing that they can score, to be calling that timeout. The coaches have to call a timeout there. I thought that could have been the difference in the game. We will never know. We will never know what would have happened. But I thought that was such a missed opportunity, two missed opportunities from the Boston coaches to call timeout and put their offensive line out there. They're your offensive line for a reason. They're the people you trust to put the disc in the end zone. And they didn't even get a chance.
Let's flip it over to the DC side for a second, because I feel like the Breeze have had three really interesting results this year. They don't quite look like I think the Breeze we're used to seeing, you know, to the point you were making about the Boston game. They were just 8 of 17 on their offensive possessions, 47%. That's the lowest mark for them going back to last season, May 7th against Philly, so in their last like 15 games. But there's a sturdiness to this Breeze team that feels more reliable for whatever reason in a gut way for me than I felt like they've had in the past couple seasons. I don't know what that is. I don't know if it will hold, but something about their way to just sort of outslug Boston at the end of that game was very impressive for me. Because I felt like for the past couple of years, DC flourishes when they're in that pristine machine mode, as we often like to refer to, when their offense is just well-oiled, moving the disc. You can't dispossess them of the disc. How they looked against Philly in week two, right? Where it's just, it's movement, 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 downfield shot if we need it. Otherwise, movement, 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 we're punching it in. Against Boston, They had that at times, but by no means consistently. And yet they got it done. And I like that tough quality to this Breeze team. I like that it's kind of becoming a little bit more Andrew Roy and Tyler Monroe centric, where it just sort of grunts out possessions and there really isn't any kind of sexiness to what they're doing, but there is this reliability. What do you think about DC's offense so far, where they're not, I think, quite to, again, where we expect them to be, but they're getting it done against good defenses?
Yeah, it's really, like you said, they've had three games that have felt so different. You know, the game out in Salt Lake, they got down early and just were kind of never able really to recover. Their offense was serviceable. It was really good at some points. It was just okay at other points. But their defense really let them down, not being able to convert break opportunities. Their Hutt game really let them down. You look at their second game against Philly, where they were nearly perfect on offense. Granted, against a Philly team that looks like, well, they look like something. I don't know. They have a CJ Colicchio sized hole maybe that needs filled. I don't know. I felt like he was pretty good for them last year, and they need to maybe retool the offense. But anyways, they looked scrappy against Boston. I think I have to agree with you. Like, it's good to see them win ugly. Because you're right, like it feels like in games in the past where their offense hasn't quite got clicking, that it was kind of a lost cause. There wasn't going to be a chance for them to win. And this game, I mean, it's as ugly as an offense as I've seen from them, as you mentioned, in quite a while. And they were able to overcome that. Like, even the fact that at the end of the game, with Boston having the disc with a chance to break to take the lead, they were able to generate a D, you know, close to the end zone and quickly punch it in. Like, that shows a level of fight and resiliency that I'm not sure past DC teams have really shown. Because whenever they were in kind of these big game moments, it really felt like they would find a way to kind of wilt under the pressure. They would find ways against Philly, who they are the big brother to, and they would find ways against teams that they would always beat, but they weren't finding ways to do that against good team, like the elite teams. They would just kind of crumble. And maybe we're seeing kind of a mental shift with them. I do think offensively, though, they've looked cleanest, obviously, in that Philly game. And I don't think it was all just because they were playing Philly. I think the personnel that was on the field just seemed to be clicking better. I think they were moving better, looked more fluid. So maybe there's something to that as well. I think you mentioned maybe addition by subtraction, by with Rowan out of the lineup. Sometimes it looks like when Rowan's on the field, they're like trying to, almost like they're trying to force the disc there, or, and it's kind of like halting, like what I would consider like the natural movement of maybe where the disc should be going. It just doesn't feel quite as fluid. Now, we've only seen three games, so I could change my mind on that, but that's kind of what I'm noticing so far early in the season. Although we said early in the season, their regular season is 25% over at this point. So there's that too.
2 points I wanted to make. I'll address the Rowan thing second. But first, to your point about the stoutness of DC's O-line defense, in their playoff elimination game against New York last year, the Empire were 7 of 8 on defensive break opportunities, 88%. Against Boston this past week, Glory were just 3 of 8 against DC. So obviously, different games, different environments, different teams. Last year's New York defensive lineup was historic. But I think it still bears out the point of there is something, like to your point, of a mental shift of getting maybe a bit more back in transition and not relying on the pristine quality of the absolute passes of your offense to sustain every single offensive drive, right? Like, there is more to offense than just getting goals in this sport, unfortunately, for offensive players. And I think you see DC making the right adjustment. And so maybe that is a credit to Lauren Boyle and her coaching staff there in DC. To your point about Rowan, yeah, something I think is off there. It's not to doubt the man and his talents at all. He came in at number 11, I believe, in the preseason of player top 25 rankings that I participated in. I personally did not put him that high. I personally did not list him in the top 25. And that's kind of because of what we saw this last week, where if you look at the box score, he had one formal turnover, but there was a stickiness to the offense in how he operated in it. It felt like he needed to get the disc from the front of a stack ISO location and get it about 5 feet out from where the current handler was possessing the disc. And it just didn't do much to shift the Boston defense. And I think there's a lot to be said for how valuable and important Rowan can be for unlocking defenses with his ability to change throwing angles, for his ability to reverse fields. But something about how he's playing in this Breeze offense right now, it feels a little bit like a toothless cog in a larger machine. To your point about the disc moves more quickly elsewhere. When there's the Gus Norbaum, Andrew Roy, even Tyler Monroe kind of ratchet effect elsewhere, with Rowan, there's a little bit of ball stopping. Just a little bit. I think it's unfortunate because it's one of those things where in 90% of other offenses, it might not be noticeable, but for how we're used to seeing this Breeze offense and for how smoothly they work it, you can see it sometimes. And again, to the point of what I was bringing up about Katz, Boston put Katz on Rowan a lot. And what Ben Katz did so well was sort of allowing Rowan to get what he wanted underneath, but then sponging off of him and immediately sealing off the next throw, right? So that 1-2 no stall continuation pass that DC loves, especially in the small ball mid-range game, that wasn't available. So then they'd have to kind of reset, dump, swing, reposition. And Boston's defense right now is good enough to anticipate those kind of looks. So yeah, I thought it was a bit surreal to watch Rowan have of an efficient performance, but otherwise not necessarily contribute to some of the attacking pressure that we're used to seeing from this Breeze offense. I think that might be the way that I put it.
Sounds good.
And look, I'm ready to be lampooned by it. I'm ready to be proven wrong. I mean, this is a person who owns an MVP and is undisputable, I think, in as far as, again, his talents. But there's clearly, from their 12-goal output, something to be said about where DC's offense currently stands.
It's a work in progress. And we'll see what happens the rest of the season. They've had essentially three unique lineups on offense in their three games. So I don't know what's going to stick. I don't know what the end point is going to look like. And they might be trying to figure that out too. Like, I don't know if they're really convinced with who the best seven out there on offense is.
Yeah.
I am glad to see that there's a little bit more consistency between the lines though. Like, we haven't seen these complete overhauls where I felt like last year we would see wildly different lines week to week where you might be subbing out three or four players. We haven't seen that. So I think that's a step in the right direction. But yeah, I will be keeping an eye on that DC offense, especially as we get further into the season and maybe they start to really cement who's going to be out there game in and game out.
Yeah, but a really impressive win for DC at home. They now hold a very important season series advantage over a Boston team that currently sits above them in the standings and continues to look very legitimate out in that East Division. Going elsewhere, though, I wanted to talk about the big performance in the West Division from the Oakland Spiders and their two-game road trip again. They win on Friday night 21-20 in Portland versus a vicious comeback attempt from the home team Nitro. Felix Morin, Nate Knudsen, and that Nitro just sort of energy bunch really feels like they're kind of coming into an identity that this team has lacked for basically the last season and a half. And I thought that Oakland did a really good job of first establishing a lead and then fending off a pretty furious charge. And then the next night against the Seattle team that was admittedly down Khalif Al-Salam, a world's level player, but a very highlight friendly and potent Cascades attack, Oakland just took care of business. Again, we kind of mentioned it at the top of this episode. There was nothing particularly pristine or I think individually impressive about the Spiders' performances. You know, they complete 95% of their throws on Friday in Portland, but only convert 54% of their offensive possessions against Seattle. They only convert 44%. They had 35 total turnovers on the weekend. But, like I mentioned at the start of the episode, this is the gritty wins that they needed at the end of last season that they just could not get. They were 7-3 going into the final weekend of 2023, just needed one win in their final two games, ended up losing both on the road in the final seconds of regulation in Los Angeles and San Diego. And this just feels like a complete reversal of that. You know, like there is just a top-down effort, I felt like, from both lines. There wasn't necessarily consistency across either, but when they needed plays, either the offense stepped up and made conversions through Evan Magsig or Walker Frankenberger, Jake Thorne. And on defense, the sort of tenacity and relentlessness of Jonah Malenfant and Jace Brunner and the rest of those units really kind of shone through against offenses that are still struggling to find themselves, I feel like, a little bit in Portland and Seattle. But what were your impressions about Oakland from watching them?
I was cautiously impressed. And here's why. They went down 7-3 in the first quarter, right?
Against like Seattle,
four
yeah.
goals against Seattle, second game of the weekend, right? Like that would be it'd be pretty understandable in that scenario. You're on game two on the road. You're down four after the first quarter against a team who's playing fresh. It would be completely understandable if they weren't able to overcome that. But not only did they overcome that, they actually were leading at halftime. They won the second quarter by 5 goals, which I'm still trying, literally scratching my head here, trying to figure out exactly how Seattle let that happen. But Oakland was just really gritty. And honestly, they are a team who is still bottom 10 in the league in completion percentage. For them to win games against, you know, a team that is vying for a playoff spot, they're going to have to be gritty. Like they're going to have to find ways to just generate wins, and they did it in very different ways, because when you look at their first game against Portland, that was a pretty low turnover game, only 29 combined turnovers, which especially for a West Division game, that might as well be single digits. You know, they play this much lower turnover game. They only have 13 turns, which for them is, you know, that's a very low number, a number that I don't think they're going to reach very often this year based on the history that we have on them over the past season plus. And then they go in the next night and it's this really high 45 turnover game between the two teams. And it's just kind of like very free flowing. People are taking shots, but they're able to kind of like counter punch their way through the game. They really just owned the middle of the game, the second and third quarters. They outscored Seattle by a combined 7 goals, and they kind of just took control there. And like you said, they held off a little bit of a comeback in both games. They were able to make plays in moments where it felt like if they didn't make the play, that could be the momentum shifting point of the game. There were multiple plays again in the Seattle game where a huck goes up, there's a tipped disc, or, you know, they're skying somebody, and it's kind of like you're uneasy the whole time the disc is in the air, and then you're like, and then they come down with it. And you're like, oh my gosh, like, had that been a D, it could have completely shifted the momentum of the game. We could see Seattle walking out of here with a 2 or 3 goal win. But it just seemed like they kept finding ways, and I think you mentioned Thorne had like a very good game. He kind of was the one, their big playmaker, especially in the second half of that Seattle game. It kind of felt like he just found his rhythm, and he was kind of in one of those zones that you can get as a receiver sometimes where you kind of just feel like every disc heading your way is your disc. And it didn't feel like Seattle could, they just couldn't find an answer for him. I still worry about this Oakland team because they get in these games, right? All their games have been close, right? And it just kind of feels like they can swing either way. They've got, you know, they don't have the hardest schedule remaining throughout the rest of the season, but it feels like any game is up for grabs.
I mean, so they have 20 or more turnovers in three of their four games. They've got, in those games, either equal to or more turnovers than scores. And yet they're 3-1, right? Like,
yeah,
it's what we talked about at the top of the episode, which is that a win is a win in this league. It doesn't have to come clean, and it doesn't have to come by a lot, but it means the same. You know, Carolina defeats Atlanta by 8 goals in week one. It equals the exact same as the 2 wins that Oakland got by a single goal in each case in week three. And, you know, there are one of now 3 teams, with Boston and Salt Lake being the others, 2-3 wins on this year. And that is an accomplishment. They're just kind of getting it from everywhere. I mean, there isn't, again, I think, an individual player you can highlight. You mentioned Jake Thorne. Walker Frankenberg got a shout out in Evan Lepler's honor roll rankings from week three. I wanted to take a second to talk about Evan Magsig and Jason Valley and what they have provided. You're a little bit familiar from Valley, coming over from the Central Division, longtime Chicago Union defender, yep, yep, where he started off with. And somebody, I think, and this is the point I wanted to build to, was somebody who was not a player you wanted with the disc in big spots. Let's put it lightly that way.
Oh,
Valley.
Let's put it more directly. He guarded me for a season or two when he was first coming into the league, and I would gladly let him catch the disc anywhere on the field that wasn't the end zone, because you just didn't trust him. And then it kind of, like, I just remember when I was guarding him, I want to say in 2022, and I kind of was allowing him to catch the under, wasn't really pressuring it too much, and he made this, like, IO flick up the seam, hit a receiver right in stride, and I'm like, wait, this isn't what was supposed to happen. That was supposed to be a turf. Like, what happened to the Jason Valley I knew and loved that would just, like, not be able to make that continuation throw? But he's, like, such a calming presence with the disc in his hands now, I think, especially for an Oakland team that struggles with to just possess the disc. I think he is arguably the person on that team I would trust the most with the disc in his hands. He's just so smooth now with his decision making and his execution of throws. He doesn't play ever outside of himself. He's never forcing anything. It's always kind of the right throw to the right space to the right person.
I totally agree with you. There is nothing exceptional about his throwing bag, and yet he's 90 of 93 for almost 97% completion rating. He currently leads the league in hockey assists. Can you imagine 4 years ago telling anybody that Jason Valley, through 3 weeks of play, would be leading the league in hockey assists? He's got 13 total scores, and he's just able to range. He has a confidence now in his sixth or seventh season in the league. Let me double check this.
I want to say 2018 might have been his first year.
Yeah, he's in his sixth season in the league, and you are totally correct. I should trust your memory on all this stuff. 2018 was his rookie.
There's a great picture of me skying him for a goal from 2018. That's why I remember that.
But to your point, I mean, on an Oakland team that needs, I think, stabilizing presences on both lines, and they get that through sort of a hodgepodge, Valley has been sort of a singular individual as far as his reliability, which is such a turnaround from where he started his career, as kind of a person that I think would be the most likely candidate for, like, a double team trap, somebody that you would kind of force the disc to and then try to get a turnover out of. And to see him sort of functioning in the opposite role in his first season with this Oakland franchise is really exceptional. And I just also wanted to pivot to Magsig, who is now in his third or fourth season with this franchise, a captain, somebody who has been coming on for a couple seasons, I think, as far as his all-around play. But his ability to pick spots right now, and his ability to, I think what you were referring to before, sort of elevate in the moments that are most important to this Oakland franchise, was so evident on the road this past weekend. I mean, he had a couple of standstill hucks to Valley, to a couple of their other bigger receivers downfield that were just so important release valves in moments in which they needed a score. And he's one of those guys who's a gamer. You know, you watch, like, 2 games of film with him, and he's just grinding. He can absolutely take over points. to that point, I also wanted to mention Max Williams, another captain for this team. I think he's often been a kind of single dimension receiver downfield, very capable in the air, very good in that role. But this year he's taking on a bit more of just a general fill role in their offense. And he had a point in their fourth quarter where he just absolutely took over in a much needed spot, basically went every other the length of the field after catching like a fast break hook. I don't know. It's one of those things where for the second straight season, Oakland might get by a little bit on smoke and mirrors as far as their execution and efficiency numbers. But when you watch them, they're such a team you want to root for. Like, they play for each other. They do all the goofy celebrations. They're absolutely fired up after everything they do. I mean, you mentioned Jake Thorne. He's screaming after every goal. Magsig, too. Walker Frankenberg, too. Like, this team likes to play for each other. And I feel like that's such an edge in a West division that's just a melee brawl.
Hey, act like you've been there before. Come on. No, I'm just kidding. I'm totally kidding.
Also, another player who continues to impress, rookie Ite Chang. It's not necessarily a surprise, but he's been such a spark plug for them and just doesn't really make any mistakes, and kind of wherever they need him to be, he's like filling in energetically. Also, rookie Dylan Burns. He's been really impressive in their red zone looks for the Oakland team. But without getting too much further in this episode, we wanted to bring back a segment that we had in the first weekend recap, real or overreaction on a couple of different points after we're sort of getting to a sense where now every single team has played. We get a sense sort of where everyone falls out on the map in the 2024 season. I wanted to start you with maybe the most pressing question, given where we started heading into this season with sort of the notion of New York versus everybody coming off of two straight championships. Is New York in trouble? Is that real, or is that kind of an overreaction?
They were idle this last week, but I think this is very real. It'll be hard to say too much for sure since we've only got two games of data, but after two games, 100%, I kind of cheated on the swing pass pod with the Ringer the Pod last week. And I went on, actually. I thought it was just for like 3 or 4 minutes. Turned out it was for 8.5 straight minutes, basically talking about all the things that are wrong with the Empire offense. And I do think there are going to be some changes, but man, they, you know, their two games so far, we've seen a close win at home against Montreal and, you know, a blowout on the road at Atlanta. They have two very tough games this weekend. We're going to know the answer to this question with a little bit more surety after this weekend, having at Boston, at Montreal. They could very easily come out of this weekend 1-3. Could you imagine a month and a half ago, if I even told you they were going to lose two games in the entire season, I would have been laughed off the podcast. They could very likely, I won't say likely, but there's a very real chance that they could be below 500, 1-3 at the end of this weekend.
Well, and just kind of in the particular order of their road matchups, you mentioned that they're on the road at Boston on Friday night, and then they face off against the Royale on Saturday in Montreal. Getting that Boston defense, getting the emotionality of having to face Babbitt and Katz, and just the general New York-Boston sports rivalry that exists across any kind of allegiances, you know? Like, this is a kind of regional rivalry that sparks above the normal tipping point, I think, of a lot of different things that we qualify as rivalries in this league. Like, all of that, and then you have to go on the road and face a Montreal team that was gaining confidence on you, even though they lost in week one. Like, they were still punching real hard in that fourth quarter. Tobe Decrane was still coming at you. Like, it is head swimming to think how much has changed in the past 6 weeks total, 8 weeks, of where we stand with this New York team and what our impressions are of them. I think elsewhere, right, as far as real or overreaction, kind of getting back to the West Coast and specifically Oakland, are they ready for the playoffs this year? Did these two road wins kind of signify to you that they're ready to take that possible third seed? You know, right now, Colorado and Salt Lake sit at a combined 4-0, and they still look like the premier teams in that division. But can Oakland fend off the LA, the Seattles in the rest of that playoff race?
So I'm going to say overreaction. I do not think that they're ready. I still don't think they're ready for it. And that's not to say they couldn't be ready at some point during the season, but the turnovers are still too big of an issue for me. They're still bottom 10 in completion percentage. They are relying on scrapping out these one goal victories. And that's just something you can't rely on. As we saw last year, it was to their downfall, right? There at the end of the season. I do think Seattle has looked like the better team. And even though they dropped this game, I still think I favor Seattle. So overreaction.
Real or overreaction, Minnesota. I know this is a little too close to home after you guys got an impressive victory, but Minnesota is still the best team in the Central Division.
Real. Until proven otherwise, they are the team to beat. And that's kind of the way I've approached everything. Even going into last year, if you would have asked me that about Chicago, despite the fact that they lost so many important pieces, I would have said the same thing. I think much like the Denver Nuggets right now, you are the king until you aren't the king anymore. Until you've seen them die on screen, they are still alive and kicking and fighting. So I need to see with my own eyes that Minnesota falters before I will pick anyone else in this division. Obviously, I have a lot of confidence in us to be able to take the throne away from them, but it's theirs until somebody takes it.
Yeah, I thought especially given their defensive adjustments over the last three quarters after Chicago kind of had a little bit of a rhythm early, was very indicative of where this team is. I feel like head coach Ben Feldman really just has that entire team, especially the defense, playing on a string, and they haven't even injected a couple of their bigger playmakers and Paul Krenek and Will Brandt this season. You know, we've talked extensively, I think, offline about the detriment of not having Abe Coffin, particularly in their vertical attack. But man, you know who's coming on all of a sudden? Matt freaking Rader, man.
Yeah, the scary man.
He really is the scary man. And I mentioned this to you in the pre-show. There's, when he looks the way that he does, and given that he kind of came out of a period where he looked a little washed, you know, 2 years, he looked like a different version of Rader. Now he's putting his head down when he initiates his sprints, and he has a separation that just has defenders falling off of him like water off a duck's back. Like, he's just getting to his spots. He's choosy. He's not necessarily, you know, pushing volume on his production, but you saw it against Chicago. He's cleaning up a skyhook. He's breaking loose for a sliding goal in open space. He's just adding an X factor that offense so desperately needs. And given how solid Minnesota is elsewhere, it's something that I think, again, to your point, unless someone displaces them and takes their crown, they still look like the top of the Central.
100%. Also, Chicago, I got a word for you.
We should just let you write another cool 4,000 words on the importance of timeouts in this league.
Man, another team who could have benefited from a timeout call, a team that was, I believe, down one with the disc late in the fourth quarter, instead turned the disc over, go down two, games essentially over.
It was weird. Call timeout. I felt like they completely abandoned their Huck game on offense. I just felt like they didn't want the vertical dimension against Minnesota's help defense deep, which was confusing given the specific personnel that the Winchell brought on the road. I felt like Chicago still had height and some individual matchups that they could have taken advantage of, and they kind of played this very possession-based but toothless version of offense that is kind of death against a Minnesota defense that is so disciplined and so knowledgeable about what it wants to do in its matchups.
Yeah, and it's just Lithiel looks like he's still finding his footing. You know, he is the new guy. It doesn't look like they've quite figured out how to integrate him into the offense smoothly yet. Certainly a very different style of ultimate than he was used to playing in New York. And, you know, he's playing with, let's just call it what it is, playing with a completely different level of talent, right? Like, it's very different when you're in a New York system where every person's a threat all the time.
Playing around multiple MVPs. I mean, what could go wrong?
Yeah, right? And then going to Chicago where they've got players, but it's not what you've been used to playing with. And maybe a little bit more attention is getting paid. To, you know, you could make an argument that depending on the team, I bet Lithiel was like the fifth, sixth, or seventh player that the other team was concerned about. I mean, in the 2022 championship game, Chicago put Dalton Smith on Lithiel because they were trying to hide Dalton Smith on defense, and they thought putting him on Lithiel would give them the best chance of doing
Didn't work out well. So, did not like, work out well.
It did not work out well. But if that tells you kind of what sort of attention he was garnering before versus certainly the attention I'm sure he's getting now, being a big receiving threat in Chicago. I think probably that mixed with the fact that he's probably trying to just still find his footing with the team, I would expect him to look much more fluid and a little bit more integrated by the time we see them, which I don't think we see them until 3 or 4 weeks from now. So, but yeah, just something to keep an eye on. I thought Chicago had a great opportunity to knock them off the throne. You mentioned down Paul Krinic, down Will Brandt, down Colin Berry.
Down Dylan DeClercq and Brett Bergmeyer on
defense.
Down
Dylan DeClercq. Yeah, and Sam Berglund even left with an injury at one point in the third or fourth quarter. Just like, if you can't beat them at home when you're basically at full strength, I know they don't have Joe White, but like, you know, Joe White is a free spirit that just kind of shows up when he shows up and you just take what you can get. You know, we know he's not going to be there for the whole season. So they're basically at full strength, and to not be able to take that one, that I'm sure they're kicking themselves over losing that game, especially going into halftime up 8-6 and only managing 6 goals in the second half. So,
but like we said earlier in this episode, it is a long season. They're still 1-1 in a division in which it figures that the winner might need only 9 wins this year. So, you know, there's still a lot of upside for Chicago, and especially with that new home venue. How about I was so impressed with that new Northwestern Stadium that they're playing at, kind of on the north shore of Lake Michigan, facing back onto the Chicago sideline. It looked real cool. I was a little jealous of the home opener crowd there. But moving on to our next real or overreaction, DC taking care of Boston, which currently sits a half game above them in the standings. But the Breeze, are they looking like the favorite out east?
I think you got to say so right now, because the other team I feel like you would pick would be Boston, and they are currently up 1-0 on Boston in the season series. Granted, it was only a 1-goal win. Boston could easily flip that and take the season series with a 2+ goal win. It's like, who else do you pick? Like, New York has not looked great. Montreal looks feisty, but probably not like they're ready to challenge.
They just snapped a 19-game losing streak, so I don't know if you can really qualify them there yet.
Exactly. Philly and Toronto look like they're just kind of going to be the bottom two teams in that division. So I almost feel like by default, DC kind of is the favorite. And that's not to say that DC is not a good team. It's just like, it kind of feels like we don't have any other options besides them and Boston. And they just beat Boston. So, yeah, I'd say that's real. And I also think that they're going to continue to improve as they kind of figure out their new personnel.
I could hear on a whiteboard in New Rochelle somewhere your words getting written up by the Empire coaching staff in their locker room somewhere. You know, just saying Boston and DC are at the top and no mention of the reigning champs.
Hey, you know what? Neither one of those teams has lost by 5 goals and only gotten 1 break in a game. So
I mean, DC did in the East Division Championship game last year against the New York, but, you know, notwithstanding.
You mean against that New York team that had, what, five players and one coach that aren't there anymore?
No, I hear you. I hear you. The first New York-DC battle, by the way, will be at DC Saturday, June 8th, just under a month away, in case anyone was wondering. Final real or overreaction. We kind of already hit on it, but I just got to ask you straight up. Carolina, are they the team to beat?
Yes. I don't want to discredit Salt Lake. Salt Lake is 3-0. They were the first team to three wins. They were idle this week, so I think it's easy to forget that they exist. You know, sometimes that happens. You're like, oh yeah, there's that team that's already, you know, won a few games. They did beat DC and looked pretty impressive in their first week. But that being said, their second and third games, granted they were on the road, down Will Selfridge, down Grant Lindsley for one of those games as well, they were not nearly as impressive. You know, the games were pretty tight, especially as they got later. LA got off to a slow start, but then kind of closed the gap a little bit. Whereas Carolina has played two games against a team that I think we believe is a very good team and has made it look pretty easy in both games. So I think right now they do look like the team to beat. I expect that they will look like at least, if not the team to beat, at least one of the top two or three teams in the league throughout the season. Unless they get hit with that injury bug like they did last year, which let's hope not, because they are fun. They are fun to watch and they are just killing it so far.
Yeah. I mean, I know it's kind of a little bit of a fallacy to rely on team statistics at this point in the season, but
sure.
The balance of the Flyers, I'm looking at their performances against Atlanta, especially this last game. They had 15 puck attempts, completed 12 of them for 80%. They had 14 red zone attempts, completed all 14 of them for 14-14. Flyers currently number one in the league, have missed just one red zone opportunity in two games against one of the best defenses in the league. And meanwhile, Salt Lake, for their impressiveness of being undefeated, they currently sit middle of the pack, 78%, for a team that finished number two last year, I think, in red zone efficiency. Bryce Merrill mentioned it actually in Evan Lepler's preseason Tuesday toss about how the new Frisbee has sort of changed their approach. They can't quite figure out how to teardrop it in like they were last year, specifically with Kerr and Dunabile finding a little bit of a mid-range zone in that end zone. Seems like Salt Lake is having a little bit of calibration issues in that area at the beginning of this year, and I think it just dents a little bit their superiority in the West, especially when you see this Carolina team just taking advantage of every opportunity that they get.
100%. Yeah, I mean, you're right. Team stats this earlier are kind of silly to look at, but gosh, do they look mind-blowing right now. I don't care if it's only two games. It's two games against a quality opponent.
Right.
And it's just like, these are video. When you hear video game numbers, this is the perfect example of like video game numbers. It's just like, you know, somebody's playing Madden on the easiest settings and just, you know, has their running back rushing for 3,000 yards. Their quarterback has 8,000 yards passing. That's kind of what it looks
like. Yeah, I mean, 80% completion from hucking range while also being perfect in the red zone. That's about as balanced of an attack as you can expect. But for as much as there's been in these first 3 weeks, I feel like leading into this next week four slate is really going to be where we get some tasty matchups. Just
juicy week.
The leading into the week four preview pod as we get set to wrap up week three's recap here. We have New York at Boston to look forward to, Salt Lake at Oakland and on Friday night, and then at Colorado on Saturday. And the first matchup between the Shred and the Summit of 2024. The two matchups last year, both were one goal Shred wins. So you can definitely expect Colorado to come out hot at home on Saturday night. You've also got Atlanta at Indy, which will figure to be an important interdivisional matchup, as well as what you mentioned before, a pretty trepidous road trip for New York at Boston, and then at Montreal. That'll all be coming up in our Week 4 preview pod in just a couple of days, but that'll do it here and now for our Week 3 recap. Cam and I, thank you so much for joining us on Swing Pass. We will be talking to you soon, but we bid you adieu for now. Bye.
Madison, Wisconsin, the capital city of Ultimate.
There's no doubt the crowd and energy and that momentum is contagious when you're on the road.
Right? We have a little bit of an experience here, and we've taken care of this team a couple
Reading
of times in the past.
Skying through the contact for the score.
Like it was nothing.
He was off.
Oh, my gosh!
And to Callahan, what? Andrew Mesnick to tie the game.
My goodness. Are you kidding
this
me?
This would be a gigantic moment for Madison.